In the last talk, we, in a sense, laid the foundations for our exploration of our modern self-obsession, and we laid out the two cosmologies. In this one, I want to move on to another reflection or statement about who God is, the God who is true to himself. The God who is true to himself, and the implications of that for self-identities today. Now, I want to do the cultural apologetic work now and talk about what I'm calling the secular aseity project. Aseity belongs to the doctrine of God. It's a very important theological concept to describe how God is the source of his own being. No uncreated God. Uncreated being. And to get at that, theologians use this idea of aseity. God doesn't need anything outside of himself to be himself, basically. So let's think about the secular aseity project, because I think today everyone believes this is possible for themselves, to create themselves. Everyone is, as someone has called it, an entrepreneur of the self. Entrepreneur of the self. I can secure my own identity. I can create myself from within. And I can be true to myself. And bring this out for everyone to see. You can see my authentic self as I'm being true to who I really am. So that's what I mean by the secular aseity project. That we can self-create. And I think for several decades, this has been our self-obsession in terms of modernity. It's hard to think of anything we invest more in than this, secular aseity. You can see this outworked in pretty much every Disney film you let your kids watch. Be careful. Lots of Disney slogans basically amounting to this: be true to yourself, resist the crowd, rise above the masses, forge your own path. This is a central religious commitment of our times. Now, it all rests in the belief that humans have the power to self-actualize. We are the self-actualizers. So here's the positive vision for how we can be self-entrepreneurs, how we can self-cultivate. And the idea there's enough deep down inside of us to be the source of ourselves. There's something solid there we just have to actualize, to be true to. So deep inside each one of us is our truest self, and we have the kind of freedom that allows us to be ourselves. And that's why you shouldn't let anyone else tell you who or what you are. Only you can discover that. So the highest ethical imperative today is to live by this principle. You are the source of yourself, so be true to who you really are. So this is the all-consuming commitment of our times. I can and I must be true to myself. Now, if you do a little bit of research on the sources of this self-actualizing project, it has different roots. Within psychology, people like Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow, these were people who were very much in the self-actualizing movement. Rogers believed that the human organism had an underlying actualizing tendency. We move in that direction. And for him, for a person to achieve self-actualization, they have to reach a state of congruence between their ideal self, who they'd like to be, and their self-image. When these two match up, boom, you've arrived. What's interesting is even Rogers acknowledged how rare it was for someone to reach this state, even though he showed the path to that. Now, I think most today who are trying to self-actualize, be entrepreneurs of self, wouldn't know much about Rogers, but this is our commitment to be our truest self. It drives the majority. Tara Burton, who sees this as a kind of religious instinct today, puts it like this: I am the only truth I know, telling me what to do and how to live. To be my truest self, I should follow my instincts. My body and my gut know more than my mind. An unjust and repressive society has held me back from becoming my best self. It has warped my faith in my own abilities and my relationships with others. I owe it to myself to practice self-care. I owe it to the world to perfect myself physically, spiritually, and morally. There is no objective right or wrong. Different people in different societies have different moral obligations. It's a good, very good description of how the secular aseity project works. Now, I think in the last 20 years, we've seen the rise of another secular aseity project going on in our times, which is quite different in its focus. And I touched on it in the last talk. Here I'm going to talk about the new techno-utopians. And this is quite another direction. Rather than actualizing from the inside to bring our true self out for all to see, this one actually uses measures from the outside to help us realize our fullest potential. So the idea here is that only by utilizing technologies like artificial intelligence, nanotechnologies, will we be able to self-create to reach the apex of our potential. So Tara Burton, again, she says, today's techno-utopianism basically worships human potential and its technological manifestations, including artificial intelligence. The utopian culture of Silicon Valley, the rationalists and transhumanists and proponents of the Californian ideology, who envision an equally radical account of human potential. Their vision of history, too, is at once linear and progressive, wending towards a tipping point of human technological progress. We will reach our full potential when we merge with the machine. So rather than looking inside to self-actualize, the techno-utopians are saying we have to be much more tactile and concrete. Many of them actually are very clear in this. There is no interior to humans. That's all an illusion. It's part of what drives them. This is just one giant chimera. What we have to do is get real and enhance ourselves from the outside in by incorporating these technologies. So this is into the world of transhumanism. So the secular aseity project from the inside out to be entrepreneurs of self, but there's also this other direction going on today, and we need to be aware of both of them. So let's think now about what the secular aseity project ignores, the things that it just doesn't take into account. I think that the first thing is it's just not working. We talked about the ironies of modernity. The great irony for me is we've never invested so much in being true to ourselves and yet never been more lost as to who we are. We really look lost at this moment. Clearly, we're not witnessing more self-stability. And all this self-belief doesn't seem to be enhancing the human condition. You could say it's probably making us more crazy than ever. G.K. Chesterton had a way of phrasing things very humorously in his book, Orthodoxy. I think he sums it up. He says, the men who really believe in themselves are all in lunatic asylums. Ouch. I believe him. He's right. So the self-aseity project is making us crazy, and that's because humans are not self-subsistent beings. We don't possess aseity like God does, and that's why we can't be true to ourselves. So I think our failure to create ourselves, to be entrepreneurs of ourselves, is rooted in some fundamental realities. First is our limited freedom. So again, within the twoism cosmology, the creator, infinite, unlimited, we are limited creatures. Back to this question you had a moment ago. We have a limited freedom. Now that's something that's not well acknowledged by modern people. It's interesting, the existentialist philosophers, people like Jean-Paul Sartre, they explored very deeply this issue of how freedom, our freedom, defines the self. And they thought this is what human freedom is for. We start as nothing. We have to will ourselves to being. It's up to us to use our freedom to come to be. So existence for them, which is our free choice, preceded our being, our identity, our essence. Freedom of choice comes before what we really are. We will ourselves to being. And for Jean-Paul Sartre, this was a zero-sum game. He really presents it starkly. It's you or me. He said, man cannot be at times free and at other times a slave. Either he is always and entirely free, or he's not free at all. Wow. I feel the burden of that. It just seems overwhelming. That's a lot of pressure, to have to constantly use your freedom of will to be, to actualize. And it's no wonder Sartre also said, we're condemned to be free. So the point is, our self-aseity projects, this creation of ourselves as being true to ourselves, is a huge and impossible challenge. Now, as we're going to see in a moment, it's not a challenge for God. And this is the beautiful thing as we look at who God is. But we have to take into account our limited freedom. The self-actualizers don't take account of that, I don't feel. The second problem with the secular aseity project is that the self can't know the self. So when we test our identity, who we are, what we really see is that we don't really know who we are, if we're honest. Augustine, through his Confessions, but many of other works, he keeps saying this in the Confessions, I'm a great question to myself. He was someone who looked within. I'm a great question to myself. Now, Nietzsche, who's not exactly Augustine, but to some degree a prophet in the modern world, he also challenges the modern aseity project. He says each subject is furthest away from themselves. We don't really get in touch with ourselves because we're subjects. We deal with what's beyond us rather than coherently understanding ourselves. Now, the fact is, when we look within, when we contemplate who we are, what we see there isn't stable. We don't see a unitary self-identity. We see multiple aspects of ourselves. And we can begin to name them, but the fact is, no one looks internally and gets the coherent view. Were great questions to ourselves. And I suggest that the Bible's designation of humans as the imago Dei, an image, gives some reflection of this fragility. An image is nothing in itself. So you look at yourself in a pool of water like Narcissus did, a bit of wind ruffles the water and your image becomes all over the place. You don't see yourself very clearly. It's only what the image reflects where the solidity comes from. An image of itself is a fragile thing. So knowing ourselves is not straightforward. That's the point. We always remain a question to ourselves. And that makes our aseity project much less secure than we think they are. That's the point. And then the third point, how can we be true to a self that's corrupted and divided? This is where the biblical doctrine of sin comes in. It's not just that the self is fragile. Under the conditions of the fall, we're also corrupted. As Immanuel Kant said, we're crooked timber, the crooked timber of humanity. We're bent. We're not what we're meant to be. So how do we actualize something which is bent and corrupt? The Bible is so uncompromising on this point. The great Solzhenitsyn, this is a well-known quote, the one who suffered in the Russian gulags, he saw this firsthand. The line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. And who's willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? If we really looked inside, that's what we see. It's part of C.S. Lewis's conversion experience. He becomes a theist, and the first thing he sees as a theist is, he was a very proud man before his theism. There's something dishonest about me. There's something proud about me. He didn't like what he saw when he looked within. So the Bible doctrine of sin is a warning against trying to be true to ourselves. We're not a straight edge. We're crooked. And you might not want to be true to your crookedness. That's the point. So let's think now a little bit about the doctrine of God here. Knowing the God who is true to himself. Because where being true to ourselves is impossible for us as human beings, the Bible reveals a God who can only be true to himself. This is the glory of the divine being. He could only be true to himself. So a foundational self-revealed truth about God is that he is the great I am. The great I am. Nothing to be actualized. He's fully himself. This revelation of God comes from Exodus 3. We know the story. Moses is out in the open country looking after a flock of goats. He's probably very bored in the hot sun. He sees a clump of bush on fire, and it captures his attention. Because as he looks at it, he notices that the bush isn't burning up. It's inconsumable. Now, as it's a burning hot day, Moses says that the sun must be getting to my head. I need to go look at this closer. And as he draws near the bush, he has this most remarkable conversation. God speaks to him. And God tells Moses his name, I am that I am. So here God is revealing to Moses his divine nature. Here's the kind of being who is absolute in terms of who he is. As we think about the absolute nature of God, we can put that in a tongue twister. It might go down at a party with someone I don't know. You could tell someone, God is a being whose is as can possibly be. He couldn't be more is. That's an ontological category. Augustine talked about God as an immeasurable, unbounded ocean of being. He's the I am. So being God, he has a distinct and infinite life of his own from within himself. So God possesses the kind of freedom where it takes no effort for God to be God. The poor existentialist, constantly willing yourself to be, it takes no effort on God's part. That's the glory of his being. Now that's what the doctrine of divine aseity expresses. I don't know about you, but several of my four children, before they were five, asked the great aseity question. Daddy, who made me? God did. And who made the world? God did, son. And who made God? And you're silent. No one did. It's remarkable. Seriously, no one made God. And the only thing that accounts for that is his aseity. God is the source of his own being. He exists in and from himself. And that gives him a free and independent life of his own. So what aseity means is that God is completely self-sufficient. He is the one and only self-actualizer. But it's not even self-actualization. He just is who he is. And he does that independent of anything outside of him. Now, we mustn't run away with this, but I actually love the doctrine of divine simplicity because it also undergirds God as the source of his own being. Divine simplicity means that God is what he possesses. So his essence is identical with his attributes. We sometimes, I think, can confuse this. So we say, God is love. Does that mean God corresponds to an idea of love outside of himself? Well, of course not. God doesn't correspond to anything outside of himself. He is love. Just as he's truth. He's not just truthful. He is truth. He's not just wise. He is wisdom. He's not just goodness. He's goodness in completely in terms of his own being. So all this adds up to a picture of one who's always true to himself. It's impossible for God to be anything but himself. He's totally consistent to who he actually is. Now, that's wonderful. If you like mythology, Jordan Peterson loves mythology, but you read the mythological gods, there's one thing you see about them. They're not very consistent. They're so arbitrary in terms of how they act into the world. God's not like that. He's utterly true to himself at all times, and that makes him trustworthy. Why do we trust God? Because of this doctrine. He's always faithfully true to who he is. But to be a Christian, by definition, is not to be the source of ourselves. We are dependent on others for who and what we are, on our parents, and ultimately on God himself. And even our character, our good character, is not sourced from within ourselves. The standards for good character, for virtue, are outside of ourselves. This is what it means to be kind. And if we become a kind person, it's likely that someone else is very much part of the nurturing of our kindness. We are dependent on things outside of ourselves for this becoming a better person. But that's not the way it is with God. He is what he is. And that's why he is always true to himself. So the point I want to make here really is that this self-authenticity, this self-creation project, this being an entrepreneur of the self is such a burden. It's killing people today. Luther would have described this as the heart being curved in on itself. The heart was created to be oriented to God, but it's curved in on itself. And that's a weight no one can bear. And I don't think it's ever been as weighty as it is today in terms of ego paganism. Jamie K. Smith, not long ago, a couple years ago, wrote a book, On the Road with St. Augustine. And he said this, which is so helpful. This weight of the self, this burden of conversion, means deciding between two burdens. That of the self reduced to itself, the weight of a dead weight, or that which I would love and which would lighten me. This outward, upward turn is Augustinian. It is the posture of a dependence that liberates, a reliance that releases. This deconstructs the myth of authenticity. In that story, I'm authentic if I'm sincere. And I'm only sincere if I act as if making things up from scratch, expressing something inside me that's all my own. Such a burden. So when we're no longer curved in on ourselves, which is the weight, but we direct ourselves to the God who's true for himself, we're liberated. That's the point. That's the true conversion. And that's why Augustine said, God is the self's place. And why in coming to God, we become ourselves in coming to him. So I think this is a moment where we need to hear Christ's great invitation. One of my favorite verses, because we live in a world that's burdened and weary. I love this verse. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. There's few promises more beautiful today than the promise of rest. Because I think people who are trying to create themselves are not at rest. That they're burdened by it. So come to me, I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So coming to Christ is the way to be light, because we're not in this excruciating, challenging business of trying to create ourselves. So our self-aseity project is a failure, and the Bible tells us why. We can't be true to ourselves, but God is, so let's go to him.